Evelyn Waugh says that the theme of Brideshead Revisited is operative grace, which is also really the theme of the Confessions, and Augustine is famously called the Doctor of Grace. But another comparison they really have is sort of this searching for love in all the wrong places, which eventually leads them to love of God.
Welcome to Faith and Culture, a production of the Augustine Institute. Every week, we explore the glory of the Catholic faith and the beauty of Catholic culture. And now, here's the host of Faith and Culture, Joseph Pierce.
Hello and welcome to another Faith and Culture podcast with the Augustine Institute. I'm your host, Joseph Pierce. And I'm delighted to have back on the podcast a guest we've had before. That's Dr. Elizabeth Klein, Assistant Professor of Theology here at the Augustine Institute. And today we're going to discuss something which I personally find very, very intriguing. And that's the comparison between two books, two great works of Western civilization that are not normally grouped together. One is the Confessions of St. Augustine. So, I suppose, for want of a better word, you could shoot me down in flames if you like, a sort of autobiography, although I know it's much more than that. And Evening Ward's Brideshead Revisited, which is a 20th century novel. You would think has very little to do with St. Augustine's Confessions, but Elizabeth is going to beg to differ, and I'm very intrigued to see where this is going to go. So, Elizabeth, would you like to maybe set us up with what do you see the framing be for discussion of these two works? Side by side.
Yeah, thanks for letting me talk about two of my favorite books. Maybe I'm inclined to group them just because I love them both so much. Evelyn Waugh says that the theme of Brideshead Revisited is operative grace, which, you know, is also really the theme of the Confessions, and Augustine is famously called the Doctor of Grace. But I think it's more than just sort of the story of operative grace working in two very different lives, which is sort of one starting point for the comparison, but also the way in which their lives unfold. You know, Brideshead Revisited is very autobiographical. It's actually sort of a cleaned up version of Waugh, but essentially autobiography. But another comparison they really have is sort of this searching for love in all the wrong places, which eventually leads them to love of God. And there are sort of a lot of parallels or touchstones in the way that that unfolds. Waugh became Catholic actually around the same age that Augustine became Catholic. And there's at least one time Waugh actually quotes the Confessions in Brideshead. I think there may be one or two other places where he's specifically alluding to the Confessions.
Can I put you on the spot, if you recall? Because I can't. I know Brideshead quite well, much better than I know the Confessions. Mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. But I can't recall whereabouts exactly in Brideshead that the Confessions is quoted.
Right. So it's in a conversation that Sebastian and Charles are having. And Sebastian says to Charles, who is it that said, Lord, make me good, but not yet? And yeah. Charles responds, you, I should have thought.
That's right.
That's a direct quote from the Confessions. But also at the very end of Brideshead, where Charles is praying before the tabernacle, he says that he's praying ancient words newly learned, which to me is an allusion to Augustine's famous, the ancient love ever knew, the reference to sort of this finding of this ancient love that he's been searching for his whole life, but which to him is still very fresh at the time of the writing of the Confessions. And those, I think he might be actually echoing the Confessions there myself.
Yeah, it's just a very fascinating and intriguing parallel. So would you maybe try to wax lyrical and eloquent on the search for love in all the wrong places, first of all, in St. Augustine's Confessions, and then maybe we'll move on to how that plays itself out in Waugh's novel.
Right. So Augustine really tracks a lot of these sort of different turns in his own sort of intellectual but also spiritual life as he goes through towards sort of the final conversion to love of God. And at the beginning of Book 3, he speaks about how he was not in love, but he was in love with love. And so he's sort of searching the streets of Babylon, as he says, for this sort of deeper longing of his heart, and you see how that turns in various directions. You know, he has the love of friendship, which he famously speaks about as friendship too unfriendly, and the pear tree story, where he has this connection with these other people, which leads him to sin, and that he has this deep relationship with a friend that dies. That's a very poignant part in the early confessions, which is a sort of turning point in thinking about what true love of another really is. Of course, then famously living with his mistress for many years and having a child, and then finally, you know, his conversion to the love of God and the abandoning of his ambitions. And that actually, I think, very much parallels some of the turns in Waugh's story, where there's a similar sort of feeling at the very beginning of Brideshead, where Charles says, I was in search of love in those days, when he's on his way to Sebastian's for the first time to meet him, you know, and he has this sort of love of Sebastian that is never quite wholesome, but also has the expression of this deeper longing in life, which, you know, then ends up turning to Julia later. And there's a very similar exchange with Julia, where, you know, he's married at this point, but he's had a falling out with his wife, or he no longer loves his wife, and so he's considering starting an affair with Julia. And she hesitates at first, and she says, I don't know if I'm ready for love. And he says something like, I'm not looking for love. And she says, oh, yes, you are.
Right.
And so this, that he has this perception that, you know, now he's jaded, but really it's the same story of him searching for love and finally finding it at the end, you know, in a kind of a most unexpected place for him.
Now, there's another aspect of Brideshead is what we might call, or what is called in the novel, thwarted love.
Mm-hmm.
You recall, I think it's Cordelia that says to Charles, this is later on in the novel, when they're both grown up a bit, Cordelia is no longer merely a child. And I think she says to Charles, I bet you sort of thinking about my life and, you know, how the religious vocation didn't work out and the marriage clearly not going to work out for me, and I bet you think thwarted.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, really, I think it's you, and I think by implication Julia, whose lives are really about thwarted love.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent do you think this, should we say, looking for love in the wrong places is thwarted, both in the confessions and in Brideshead, and what do you think that thwartedness is?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is there in both of them. I mean, I think both Augustine and Waugh have this great capacity for love, and capacity for greatness as well. I think ambition is another thing that's an overlap between Augustine and Waugh. They're both skilled at rhetoric and skilled at writing, and they have this great desire to express themselves, which, you know, until they find God, doesn't really have the fullness. It's thwarted. It doesn't reach its proper end. And so that's how I would see it as thwarted, that the impulse, the desire of every human heart is there, but it's not reaching the goal. And so it comes up short. And so I think that's kind of what Cordelia is alluding to with the thwartedness of their love, that they have this great inner life that's reaching out and just never gets there.
But see, that's one way, and I agree with that completely, that thwartedness is because of the incapacity of the human, in the absence of the fullness of grace, to be able to reach the love for which the soul aspires. And again, I can't recall in the Confessions, but in Brideshead, the two powerful metaphors for grace are violent. Okay, so the twitch upon the thread, which is mm-hmm. the title of the second part of the book, and the metaphor of the avalanche, right? The hunter's hut and the sun on the slopes above melting the ice, and then an avalanche which basically turns this little cozy world,
mm-hmm.
you know, the metaphor is obviously Charles's cozy world, to splinters, to fragments, and there's nothing left. So to what extent does God do the thwarting? In other mm-hmm, words, to what mm-hmm. extent is it not we're thwarted because of our own incapacity, but God doing the thwarting in the sense that he's actually using, for want of a better word perhaps, violence in order to bring us to where we need to be so that we can actually have love in its fullness.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. One of Augustine, this isn't in the Confessions, but one of Augustine's favorite images for operative grace is in the life of St. Paul, which he sees very much as a sort of, you know, direct act of God turning Paul from his old ways, and he speaks of it as an arrow, you know, and Augustine has that idea of sort of the piercing of the heart of God seeking after him. You know, it isn't just him going astray, but it's God pursuing him actively as well. So yeah, I think that that's definitely a part of Augustine's understanding of operative grace.
And there's also, you bringing some point into the conversation, I mean, there's wonderful comparison in Jeremiah Hopkins's poem, The Wreck of the Deutschland, where he talks about the two types of conversion. I think that the phrase is the one sort of crash Paul or the slow melting Augustine. You know, so because obviously in the Confessions, Augustine takes an awful long while to actually come to an acceptance of the love of God. Right, he looks in all the wrong places. Whereas St. Paul, of course, is knocked off his horse literally, and literally knocked, has sense knocked into him with that sudden image. To what extent in Brideshead do we see those two types of conversion? We discussed the violence, the metaphors of the avalanche and the twitch upon the thread, but what about the slow?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of both and in Brideshead, really, because looking back, Charles does see this slow movement and how all of these, you know, wrong loves, he ends up calling them forerunners to the final love. So he ends up looking back, seeing that sort of slow conversion, as Augustine does. But both actually, in Augustine's case and in the case of Charles Ryder Waugh, there's sort of a watershed moment, right? So there's obviously the take and read moment where Augustine finally has this turning point and this buildup is, you know, bears fruit. And for Brideshead, right, you have that moment between Charles and Julia where she finally says, no more, you know, I'm done with you. And he responds, though, saying that he already knew, even though he'd been sort of in denial about that moment, and that moment sort of this crashing in of his world, and he's lost his wife, and now he's lost his mistress, and he's real loveless in middle age, as he says. He, looking back, he says, no, I already knew. I've known since the beginning of the year that it was going to come to this. So, yeah, I think for both of them has both of those dynamics kind of at work.
What do you think the significance is of the fact that in Waugh's forward to the second edition of Brideshead, when he makes that statement that you've said about the theme of the book is the operation of divine grace in the lives of closely connected people, or worse to that effect. Now, of course, what that means is that in many ways the protagonist of Brideshead, as indeed the protagonist of the Confessions, is God.
Yeah.
And I think I've taught Brideshead many times, and I think we miss the deepest elements of the novel if we leave the main protagonist out of the picture. Mm-hmm. So to what extent, for instance, you know, at the pivotal moment, the climactic moment, and pivotal, towards the end of the novel, Lord Marshmain's conversion. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it is that only the miserable sinners are around? In other words, Cordelia's not there, right? Bridie's not there. Obviously, Lady Marshmain has died. So it's just Julia and Charles who are left holding the fort when Lord Marshmain's dying. Why do you think Waugh would do that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about that moment, which I think Waugh later found a little bit too much, right? That scene, he thought maybe it was a little too obvious. But you're right in the sense that that's sort of God's big moment. You know, God finally does something that is so visible that we can see. And you know that there is a sort of parallel there to the incarnation. I've come to save the lost, you know, I've come to sinners, that really what Charles ends up interpreting is a kind of miracle happens.
Right.
And I love that scene because it's so mundane in the way that God is working throughout the whole book in a very mundane way. But all of a sudden you realize, oh no, that was God in the mundane. It wasn't just, you know, and even this kind of thing happens in life all the time where Charles makes that prayer, you know, give some sign, Lord. Basically, not for me, because I'm not really that interested, but at least for Julia.
Yeah.
And then when he receives a sign, all of a sudden it's even though from the outside you think, oh, well, it could be just a coincidence or whatever. I mean, from Charles's perspective, that will never be anything other than a miracle, right, than an answered prayer. And so I think that, yeah, that's just a really interesting...
It's really beautiful because it's the first time that Charles ever prays. Mm-hmm. And it's an act of love because he's not praying for himself. Mm-hmm. He's praying for the woman he loves who he's just lost. So it's a real act of self-sacrifice, which is the very essence of love, of course. And that, you have to believe this is the beginning of the avalanche that destroys Charles as well. It's also the beginning of the conversion, which actually brings him to obviously a much deeper joy than he would have had before. I'm going to end by griping against Evening War, if you don't mind.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, you know, I think that War, like Graham Greene, is actually guilty of being a little bit too cynical and jaded for his own good. I think that Graham Greene famously said that he didn't see things in black and white, he saw them in black and grey, which I think is hideous, quite frankly, because it really denies the existence of a pure good, and that everything's polluted by evil, right? Mm-hmm. I was putting things the wrong way around. But I think War, up to a point, was always too cynical to be comfortable with moments of absolute beauty. And I've taught Brideshead many times, and I've never managed to read the passage of Charles's prayer, Lord, and then the miracle, the crossing of Lord Marshmain, crossing himself, without my voice choking up. And I've taught it many times, right? So I don't think it's too much. I think it's that scene is a moment of astonishing beauty, where the penetration of grace doesn't just enter the story in a profound way, it leaps from the pages into our own lives in our experiencing of it.
And the very end of the book is also so beautiful, him praying alone in the chapel. And you know, you do have that uncharacteristically optimistic moment at the end, right? The very last line is something like, you know, you look happy today, Charles, or something right? So there is a sort of optimism. And maybe, I mean, it was the later War, right? He says something like, I wrote that book on an empty stomach, and now that my stomach is full, I found it quite distasteful. But maybe there was something about the fact that he's in the midst of war and able to see life from maybe a little bit different perspective, that you get that optimism and beauty coming through in Brideshead, that even though his later self thought it was maybe a bit much, we can still appreciate the perspective that he had at that moment when he wrote it.
I think his later self got it wrong. And it happens, you know, I mean, War, anyway, I don't want to go too much on the tangent. I said we were going to finish, but I'm going to indulge ourselves one more time, because just another image has come to me about paralleling between the confessions and Brideshead, and that's the two very important ladies. Because it seems to me that there's a parallel between St. Monica, the Christian who has to deal with the wayward son, and Lady Marshmain, right? The Catholic who's got her family in all sorts of a mess. Would you maybe want to make some comment about the parallels between the two ladies?
Yeah, that's actually really interesting, because in a sense, Julia in the end kind of credits her reconversion to her mother, right? She refers to her mother carrying her sin with her to church, carrying it with her to the grave, praying for her. And so there is a sort of parallel between that and then the tears of Monica, right? That such tears would obviously be able to convert her son. So they do have a kind of parallel, those mother figures, although, you know, Lady Marshmain's maybe a little more complex than Monica comes across in the confessions.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, she's definitely a complex character and a very controversial one. And my favourite paper prompt when I taught Brideshead was Lady Marshmain, innocent or guilty? ? And what the students had to do was to give the case for the defence and the case for the prosecution and then the verdict. So I didn't want them just to say, oh, she stinks or she's a saint. I mean, I'd have got to show both, they understand both sides. But see, if that novelist work on the supernatural level, and War quite clearly says it is, then Lady Marshmain doesn't leave the action. She doesn't leave the story up when she dies. Right. And nor is she only present in terms of memory. Mm-hmm. Right? We can really believe that if she's in a position to actually pray for her own family, and certainly if she's made it to heaven, and maybe the suffering she went through that during her life was the purgatorial experience that got her to heaven, then obviously her intercession is going to be much more powerful than her rather inept efforts when she's on Earth. And I think that whole mystical dimension of the novel is it causes us to ponder. Do you have any final thoughts on the two works? And
perhaps since we're talking about the late Waugh's view of Brideshead, maybe we should end with the late Augustine's view of the Confessions, which was that, unlike Waugh, looking back at the Confessions at the age of 70, you know, when he's writing the Retractions, he says that he, you know, wrote the work to move people to love of God, and he still finds it does that when he himself reads it. So. Yeah.
See, well, I don't want to pass judgment on where Evening Waugh is at the moment.
But it is, yeah, St. Augustine Saint, and not so St. Waugh.
It is St. Augustine, not St. Evening, right?
Yes.
So thank you so much, Elizabeth, for joining us and what I found an absolutely fascinating and unusual and intriguing parallel between these two great works. Please do come and join us again. I forgot to mention, introducing Elizabeth, that apart from being Professor of Theology here at the Augustine Institute, she's also the author of the forthcoming book in the What Every Catholic Should Know series, God, What Every Catholic Should Know. Well, every Catholic should know God, every Catholic should know more about God. So please check out Elizabeth's book when it's published, which will be sometime soon. Elizabeth Klein, thank you so much.
Thanks.
And I'm Joseph Pierce. I've been your host in this Faith and Culture podcast of the Augustine Institute. Please do join me next time. Goodbye and God bless. Go.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Faith and Culture with Joseph Pierce. Faith and Culture is a production of the Augustine Institute. For more information, please visit us at faithandculture.com.